everyone. I'm Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center and today the political right. And joining me on the political left is Shireen Gourvani.
Hello. And listeners, you've followed along for many unsupervised sessions that I've had with John Dougal, who's under the weather today, and we're hoping he's feeling better. But we just, now you and I are unsupervised.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay.
And
I
hope you feel better soon, John.
Yes. So,
where do you want to go first, Shireen?
Well, we usually start with global. And I will say one thing that is hard for me to take out of my mind are the impacts of the flooding that we're seeing in Nepal. What's coming to mind for you there?
Oh, just the images.
Yeah.
You know, the images and trying to understand, you know, what created this. And then what do you do?
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of times in this case, it's the responders that are at risk because they're worried about more floods. And certainly global warming comes to mind a little bit.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So my understanding is that the reason that this massive flood is happening is actually pretty directly linked to a glacier collapse. So we're thinking about just the warming climate, what that's going to mean for places around the world and what it's going to mean for emergency response. I think about this back, to my days on the county council, the amount of infrastructure that we have, for example, here in Salt Lake County would still be immensely strained under some sort of circumstance like this. Then you think about a remote, corner of the world with not the same level of infrastructure, certainly not the same level of government funding to respond to natural disasters, and frankly, more and more of them.
Yeah,
all the time.
And the amount of debris that went through this Himalayan Valley, I've seen the before and after photographs.
Yeah.
It's a stunning, don't mess with Mother Nature.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. That's right. What else is on your mind on the global scale?
Oh, how about Lake America?
Oh, yeah.
My husband commented to me, so of course this is Lake Ontario, that through executive order, if I've got this right, President Trump has now named Lake America. My husband reminded me that the Canadians are Americans too, and it works.
But, yeah. Yeah, right.
But I'm not a big fan of this. I remind my husband that what an executive order does is repealed by another executive order in a stroke of a pen.
That's right.
I don't think this will have staying power.
No, I don't either. I think what's incredible to me about this is basically we now have the naming of, Lake Ontario to Lake America to distract from a trade war that is fundamentally going to drive up prices for everyday Americans, which I believe was a distraction from the Iran war, which was a distraction from the Epstein files. So I think for me, just the layering upon layering of distractive activity by a administration simply out of control leads us to the dumbest possible outcome where we're arguing about Lake America as opposed to going back to really what is happening at sort of the core of this presidency, which feels like cover up, misinformation, a misguided policy, and engagement in never-ending war.
So, Shireen, you've seen this before because the reckoning happens perhaps at the midterms, but in the past, the reckoning has favored Donald Trump.
It has.
And so do you feel like you could be fooled this time? Because I'll bet you're thinking that the midterms are going to correct some of this.
I do think so. I recently saw, that was just this morning, was reading that Donald Trump's approval rating is the lowest it has been. So I think we've
been in the 33, 34,
I think we're down
something
to like
that.
31.
30,
yeah.
Oh, my. Okay.
So this is catastrophic, right? And what it does suggest is there is a point at which we have become, as a body, as a nation, frustrated with the lack of, frankly, focus on issues that impact our lives or engaging in these wars for no good reason. So I do think at some point, we've always sort of wondered, will gravity take hold? It did in 2018. There was a snapback there. And I have to wonder now if people have the right to vote and if they understand that their votes still count, which they still do. Please, everyone vote. That we're likely to see across this nation, I think, some pretty significant shifts.
Yeah. The conventional wisdom is he's defied, meaning President Trump has defied political gravity many, many times, but he can't defy economic gravity. And over time, it just wears
down.
Yeah, wears down. So on the trade point, let's go to these ranchers in our country that are really upset that Donald Trump has this announcement that he'll import, 300,000 metric tons of tariff-free beef.
Yeah.
From Argentina, if I've got this right, or is it from a lot of other places?
Other places.
But it will really affect local beef.
It
brings down prices.
Right.
When you increase supply, price falls.
Right.
Another place where this president you know, is doing something that kind of messes with the market.
Yeah. So interesting to see Senator Curtis speak out on this, saying, quote, "While I appreciate the intent to lower food prices for consumers, importing foreign beef to be sold at artificially depressed prices undercuts Utah's family operated cattle ranchers and poses long term risk to our domestic supply chain stability." This is something that that really resonates with me. Mm-hmm. My family, you know, my mom grew up on a farm, the family farm that we weren't able to hold on to, just given the kind of conglomerations mm-hmm. that are really taking over food production in this country. To think about the cattle ranchers that are still holding on in this state and frankly in this country, to see this absolute slap in the face by this administration, as opposed to really considering all of the ways in which cattle ranching has already been deeply impacted by this administration's moves is stunning. And it's been interesting to see these ranchers, you know, I don't think it's particularly productive, but folks on the left saying, well, who'd you vote for? Right.
Yeah.
But very often, I think people who are working in agriculture may find themselves to be quite maybe socially conservative. Maybe, not always, but certainly understand farm policy and what these mm-hmm. kinds of trade agreements mean better than most people.
Yeah. Well, and then you've got what's happened in Venezuela with oil.
Yeah.
And this one's interesting. I would encourage our listeners to watch for this because the Trump administration's now confirming that they've struck a deal with Venezuela to control 65 billion barrels of Venezuelan oil. The question, what I prompt to our listeners is, how do we do that? We don't have a national oil industry, meaning a company, you know, right. like Pemex or something.
Right.
This means that Chevron or Exxon or somebody, I don't know how the mechanism is where the U.S. controls when we don't have a nationalized oil company.
Right.
I also saw an interesting report, Shireen, that mentioned that the reserves in Venezuela were greatly exaggerated.
Yeah.
And it's not about the amount of reserves, but the amount of recoverable reserves. Yeah, that it's expensive to get it. And so, and this is very common for, you know, countries to inflate something, especially a country like Venezuela.
Yeah.
And then you look, you know, below things and you start to see it's a little different than they were portraying.
Than they were, yes. Yeah. Well, so again, kind of back to this category of misinformation that seems to be a real part of this, a real hallmark of this administration. I think the question that I have for you when I think about these stories, whether it's, you know, the moves on beef or talking about oil reserves or, you know, how is it? And I know that you have not been a fan of Donald Trump mm-hmm. and his policies. But when you think about what this means to Republicanism, mm-hmm. what comes up for you?
Oh, I think there's a rebound of conservatism at some point in some shape or form, because I think conservatism is based on solid principles of free enterprise and, you know, market economies work.
Yeah.
Conservatives want the market to be your first place you go to. And if the market fails, then you intervene.
Right.
You know, then when you've got pollution, when you've got a monopoly or something. But you don't go as a first order to government. Government's not good at allocating resources.
Yeah.
And so we depend on a price signal to do that. And so what you're asking me, Shireen, is what's next for the Republican Party? I don't know. That's the question a lot of people are asking. But I do think that conservatism finds its way because it's solid theory.
I'm really interested in the statement you made that, you know, government's not good at allocating resources. Mm-hmm. That's what you just said. Mm-hmm. Now, that's where I'm curious.
Yeah, it's
that
not.
Makes me really curious.
Well, think of the Soviet Union and, you know, 5-year plans, 6-year plans and whatnot.
Yeah.
You sit in a room and you plan, how many toasters do you make? How many cars do you produce? You know,
sure.
Who gets them? That's what markets do really well.
Sure. And I guess when I'm thinking of ways in which government allocates resources well, I think about the joy that I have each day my mail shows up. We run a postal service, a national postal service. I think about the regularity and ease largely with which our Social Security Administration seems to work. I think about, you know, when we invest, things like our road infrastructure, you know, all this kind of stuff. So I think there are big things that government does well in terms of asset or prioritization or right. allocation. Right?
Yeah, right.
Though I would say, you know, as a person who's often irritated and frustrated by military spending in this country, that seems like an easy place for me to go and look and say the amount that we're spending, for example, on contractors
yeah, right.
or paying for things over and over again, all the way back to one of my favorite books and sort of the story of the beginning of the Peace Corps, The Ugly American, right? Which tells the story of basically our government building a bridge over a dried up river,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
We do things like that.
So one of the market failures, Shireen, is when, you know, the market has an unfair distribution of things.
Yeah.
And markets would not deliver mail to rural America.
Right.
They would not.
Right.
And so we made a decision as a society to have a national mail service that
right.
delivers to rural America and equalizes that.
Right.
So the way that economists and conservatives think of things like that is they have to justify when there's government intervention. It's, you know, you have a National Weather Service because we have information failure, and it actually makes sense to have weather information there for all of private enterprise, the airlines, other
right.
things to operate from. So
right.
anyway,
I
think conservatism gets a rebound. And I think that, you know, what we're doing right now is a reordering that's fixing some overreaches. But there's also inherent in that some problems, complexities that
right.
I want to see addressed.
Well, and difficult with a chief executive that doesn't seem to have a core principle.
Well, you know, interestingly, Chief Justice Roberts just took him on.
Well, that's true. Yes.
Yeah, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of Trump's ballroom. This was a, you know, sort of a competition, I guess, or a suit brought by the National Trust for Historic Preservation. They wanted to block the project. And the Supreme Court has basically said in a 5-4 ruling that the ballroom construction can continue, but Chief Justice Roberts joined with the liberal justices in this regard.
Yeah, dissenting. So I was listening to a little bit of news on this morning. One of the things that I thought was interesting here was basically that they said that those who had sued did not have standing to do so.
Yeah, so that's a legalese kind of thing.
So there could be, it would be interesting to know who does have standing.
Yeah, on this.
And let's see if it moves forward.
Let's take a short break and then we'll chat about some more local news in the second hour. Natalie Gochner with Shireen Gurmani. Stay tuned. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on UPR. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email BSOTAPodcast@gmail.com. That's BSOTAPodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Shireen Gurmani on the left.
And Natalie Gochner in the political center and political right. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. What else do you want to talk about, Shireen?
Well, there are many, I think, local items of interest. One thing that did stand out to me was this landmark settlement over teens and social media addiction. Mm. So Meta has reached a landmark $17 billion settlement over teens and social media. This is really in alignment with efforts that we've seen, I think, discourse that we see here in Utah.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's part of a much broader concern about the ways in which people, especially young men, are further isolated by online mm-hmm. living. I don't know that I would lay that all at the feet of Meta or, you know, social media, but certainly we've seen and talked about on this program the reporting around the ways in which, for example, Instagram basically targets eating disorders at young women, the way that outrage is fed to us, prioritized over sort of all other
right.
news. And I do think that it's part of a broader conversation about social disconnection. So it'll be really interesting to see, because some of these dollars will come to Utah.
Yeah.
And what will we do
with
that?
Can you imagine? So this was AGs from 47 states and the District of Columbia, I think, is right.
Yeah.
But who are those states that didn't jump on this?
Yeah, no kidding, right?
And this harkens back when I worked in state government. We got a big tobacco settlement.
Yeah.
And we did incredible things with that money.
Yeah.
You know, and so this is really good news for our state, a real compliment to Governor Cox here and to our Attorney General
yeah.
for making this happen.
Yeah.
They have to be on their game and make their arguments. Can you imagine what it was like in the Meta, either boardroom or executive team room, the night before they decided to do this?
Yeah, well, I can imagine, because one of my favorite and most distressing books that I read last year was about, oh my goodness, now I'm not even going to be able to remember the name of it, but it'll come to me. Oh, geez.
But $17 billion settlement.
Right. Well, so this book was about a person who worked inside of Meta, in particular started with Facebook, wanting to advance an agenda around thinking about their role in the world kind of globally.
Mm-hmm.
And
their obligation to humanity to make the
yes.
world a better place.
And the lack uh-huh. of reflection that they had as they were building power was breathtaking, but it really, I think, leads us to a moment like this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now we're seeing that there are some concessions. Basically, there are new parental features. And what absolutely guts me about this is they could have turned these on at any time. Mm-hmm. They could have known that these were available tools to reduce people's addiction.
Pro-child, pro-family,
that
pro
could have been, right?
Civil society it would be.
Yeah. So
two-hour limit.
Yep. Yep. So that teens cannot, there's a night mode that blocks Facebook and Instagram access between midnight and 6 a.m., a school mode that would mute notifications during the school day, regular prompts after 15 minutes of continuous screen time. They could just actually go ahead and close themselves at that point.
How
that would be nice to see.
My favorite is to turn off the to choose actually the non-algorithmic feed.
Yes.
I love that because I get so frustrated when I'm on, let's say, X or whatever, and it's following versus not following.
Right.
I always want to be my following, but it keeps pushing me back
pushing
to the other
back.
One.
Yeah.
I want to get back on the ones where I pick who I get to see.
Yes. Now, I will say the best thing that we could probably do in response to all of this is try to get further removed from these.
Yeah, no doubt. No question about it.
And find those places for social connection, whether that's, I know, faith-based organizing and like coming together in that way is important to you. I think about volunteering in your community, getting involved, actually just going and knocking on your neighbor's door. Yeah. If you see him sitting outside, go talk to him.
And, social connection, top of the list. Also connection with Mother Nature.
Yes.
I think that's huge. Or with art.
Art.
Right.
Yeah.
Whether it's performing arts, whether it's just, seeing sculptures and painted arts, whatnot. I spent some time up in the Wasatch this weekend. It was rainy, but boy, was it uplifting for me.
Yeah.
Nice 8-mile hike, and I just felt so enriched after it.
I don't know if it's the Midwestern in me, but I really, of course, love to watch a rainstorm.
Yeah,
and I have a little, covered front porch, and it was so sweet to see my son, who's now a sixth grader, as soon as it started really raining, he said, I just love to watch the rain, and went out and just sat there and watched it. The amount of time that he intentionally chooses to look at something for an extended period of time that's not a screen, every minute to me is a win, that he's taking it in.
How closely, Shireen, did you follow this sort of discussion between the state and Salt Lake City about the former slave who was lynched on Capitol Hill and having a little
memorial.
Plaque that memorialized this tragedy?
Yeah, so I haven't closely followed this, but basically my understanding is that Salt Lake City unveiled a plaque last week memorializing Thomas Coleman, a 33-year-old hotel worker whose corpse was discovered just off of the Capitol nearly 160 years ago. So it's an offsite recognition that really just came, I would say, shortly after a controversy that we talked about here about Utah lawmakers wanting to put in, a piece of art without public input. Mm-hmm. So I think these are kind of interesting when it comes to the public process that is involved in these. And I would just always ask for greater public participation. Mm-hmm. And it would, I think, serve us well to know the story and have more engagement.
It's kind of interesting. I didn't know about this issue until just recently. But apparently our Senate President House Speaker voiced their dissent, and the Republican representatives on the Capital Preservation Board voted to block this.
Yeah.
I spend a lot of time at the Capitol, not just professionally, but my daughter lives near the Capitol. So I'm on the grounds. I walk my grandson around there.
Yeah.
I just see things. It's an interesting place because it's a place where, discourse happens.
Yes.
It's a place where disagreement happens.
Yeah.
It's a place where protests happen. It's almost rare to go up State Street and make that left or right turn without someone being there.
Yeah.
And, maybe this would have been, what the idea would have been is they would have put this plaque very close to where the lynching happened.
Right.
Which, as long as it's historically accurate, I would support that.
Yeah. Same. Yeah, so I'm trying to think of where else we could go. But, I would like to talk about the recent article that I read in The Atlantic, another McKay Coppins piece, an interview with our governor, Spencer Cox, ahead of the release of his book.
Yeah. And McKay Coppins, for our listener, he's a staff writer for The Atlantic. He's LDS.
Yes.
He wrote Senator Romney's biography.
Yes.
And he's the guy that Senator Romney gave all of his papers to write it.
Yeah.
Gave him total freedom to document this amazing leader's life. So McKay's a thing.
Yes.
I've met him. Have you met him before?
I have not met him. But wow, I have some questions for him now.
Yeah.
So it's a short piece, but there were some pretty interesting moments in it. One of which, and we're recording this basically on the close to the 1-year anniversary of the assassination, tragic, of Charlie Kirk at UVU. And one thing that stood out to me in particular was that McKay Coppins describes the crisis of Spencer Cox's governorship as that moment.
Mm-hmm.
I think that moment was horrific, complex. Mm-hmm. I think others may have handled it worse. I think others could have handled it better.
Mm-hmm.
But when I think about a defining crisis of a governorship, mm-hmm. I was very surprised to see that noted as the kind of key thing. When I think about how many Utahns died during COVID, which was the beginning of this governor's tenure. When I think about the amount of people, small businesses that have closed as a result of tariffs and the honestly just like the chaos in our economy right now. When I think about our lake drying up and all of the ways that what feel to me like real crises, not that this wasn't a real crisis, just that to see someone lead through something as complex as getting people focused on the lake,
mm-hmm. right?
That feels like a defining moment in a governorship.
I think it's a fair point, Shireen, but I think Governor Cox's leadership during this tragedy, this public assassination, this tragedy was top tier from my perspective. I even texted him during it to just say, wow, thank you for representing our state so well. I think the difference, Shireen, is economic problems, you know, wait lists, people that don't get health care, they're always here.
Yeah.
We're always working through those. I mean, the economy ebbs and flows. But when you've got eyes of the world and certainly of the nation focused on a university in Utah after a public execution, I mean,
yeah.
That and who's going to stand up and lead?
Yeah.
Is it the president of the university? Is it the head of, the Provo Police Department, Orem Police Department, wherever is it? Who is it? And the governor assumed that role and took it and ran with it. And I feel really good about what he did.
Well, and I think the question I have then is here a year later, have we been led? Are we in a different place?
Yeah. And you're saying like in the disagree better world.
Yeah. For example.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't know that we are.
I'm really excited to read the governor's book. Not yet. I pre-ordered it. So it'll show up. Because it's right now being released, as I understand it. Apparently, he explicitly states right in the first line of the book that he's not running for president.
Yeah. Well, I don't.
That tells you the kind of platform this book is.
Maybe. Uh-huh. We'll see who reads it. But then I'm also curious about that in terms of, I feel like many people, that's what you kind of have to say, right?
Okay, sure.
You
can change your mind on it. You can
change your mind on it. But it
also shows you what a big deal the Charlie Kirk, murder was because it puts our governor in a place where people are asking.
Yeah.
They saw him. They liked him.
Yeah.
But the other thing I would say is that he's operating in a world of division and polarization in politics, and he's trying really hard to navigate it. And you could be critical of it, but it's not easy to do.
No, I agree with you. It's not easy to do. And I think the thing that is curious to me about political polarization in the context of Utah is I wonder how much of it, and I'll be curious to read it. I probably will read it.
Yeah.
Are we talking about, and maybe if you'd like us to do a book club, maybe we'll do a book club and we'll read it together. And then I would suggest
you don't every day get a book from your sitting governor. You get it after the fact. But he's written this while he's governor.
Yes.
That's a question I have. Like,
that's
how did you find time for that?
Right. And maybe we can put a book that I would maybe choose as part of our little book club idea here, too. If you like it, let us know. Email us. But anyway, what I was going to say to that is I'm curious about, because when I look at this administration, frankly, what I see are sort of moderate Republicans trying to hold the center against extreme Republicanism. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, is that a lesson I'm interested in? Is that a mm-hmm. discourse I'm interested in? Not really. Mm-hmm. But what I don't see this governor doing is really pulling in, persuasive, outspoken people on the left or maybe in opposition to really forge ahead with a vision for the state that exemplifies, that lives this sort of disagree better. I think, what I often see, unfortunately, is him having takes or reactions to when the public is upset that are demeaning and dismissive of people's concerns. Mm.
I find him a very level-headed, balanced guy.
Yeah.
I also really respect how he's worked with his lieutenant governor to navigate all this election stuff.
She's been incredible.
And he had that job before, so he knows what she's been going through. And apparently he's not put any kind of muzzle on her,
right?
Which is wonderful to see.
Yeah, it's
that partnership,
see.
How they work through that.
Yeah.
But let's be clear, nobody looks good right now in terms of like disagreeing better, because it's a hard time with all of the discord.
Yeah. I think that's true.
I just think it's hard to be on your best every moment.
It's hard to be on your best every moment.
And I'll say on the Charlie Kirk stuff, and that to get up there in front of all the, CNN cameras and say, we need an off-ramp.
Yeah.
I really respected that.
Yes. And I would love to see in greater detail what that looks like in practice.
Yeah.
Yep. So take it beyond the pages of a book. Take it beyond a tagline.
Yeah.
And let's really implement what that looks like here in Utah.
And the program. We might see that in whatever he does next.
Okay.
So let's see.
I'm curious about that.
Hey, great program, Shereen. Thanks for the conversation.
I hope, listeners, you were okay with us being unsupervised.
Yeah. And thanks to Anthony Scoma for producing the program. Have a great day, everyone.